Hey folks, welcome to Newsprint Commando. I'm your host, Ed Moore. We are in the midst of a Pacific Tuesday, looking at those books put out by Pacific Comics July of 1983. If you want to get in touch, you can find Teal Productions on Blue Sky, on Facebook, and on Twitter. NewsP Commando is on Twitter as well. I am Teal Productions, so the show is on Twitter at NewsP Commando. IamIndieMan@gmail.com is the email address. Indie is INDIE. The website, comicbooknoise.com/TNC, Tango November Charlie. Now looking at the cover here, it's a cover penciled, inked, and colored by Mr. Gray Morrow, and he is featured in this book. Actually, the book is pretty much a vehicle for him. He has the primary story of about two-thirds of the book, and then there's a tertiary story. Well, it's not even related. There's a short story also by another creator that I'll get to here in a few moments. But on this cover, when you look at the cover, well, let me step back. When I look at the cover, I see Hercules fighting a bunch of dudes, some armed, some unarmed, swords. He's wielding a big battle club of some sort, kind of ornately decorated. In the background is a scantily clad female who is holding back a more ruggedy, armored-looking gentleman drawing a sword. So she is apparently letting this gentleman that I think looks like Hercules, Steve Reeves, actually, is who comes to mind now that I think about it. She's holding back this her guard or maybe her companion while they let Hercules, or she lets Hercules, fight unfettered, it seems. Inside, we have a page from the editor, David Scroggie, introducing us to the book. Now, he calls this Gray Morrow's Edge of Chaos. The indicia says Edge of Chaos, and the cover says Edge of Chaos. So that's what I'm going with, Edge of Chaos. But as I said, this was designed to be a vehicle for Mr. Gray Morrow. Now, the story itself is scripted, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered all by Mr. Gray Morrow. The narrator tells us, or perhaps Gray Morrow tells, no, I don't know. It's the editor, as far as we know. There are worlds within worlds within worlds. This, then, is a tale of one of those worlds. Then and now, a world on the edge of chaos. By Gray Morrow. Copyright 1983. We have four vertical panels. The fourth and final vertical panel is cut in two, the panels proceeding from left to right. Night riders glide across a velvet sky, and we see some robed, all robed, we don't even see what kind of creatures they are other than they are humanoid, bipedal, riding what appears to be, to my eye, pterodactyls. And that's in the first panel. The second panel, we see a city that we presume either they are approaching or coming from. We see a parcel that has been dropped. The second panel, the narrator tells us, towards a gigantic city ship suspended in the heavens. So there we go. The pterodactyls are flying towards the city. And then in the third panel, and drop a shapeless, wrapped, and tied bundle to the courtyard below. And it is vaguely humanoid, like a body that's been wrapped in cloth. Then noiselessly wings away, and we see an individual come running up, thinking, curse Moloch, he's done it again. And a much more stately gentleman comes up as the parcel is unwrapped and says, so, another champion is defeated. Moloch mocks us once again. So this Moloch, these winged dudes here, or not winged, but the dudes riding the pterodactyls, they must have been like the messenger boys. And the message they were leaving is this hero that was sent, presumably, to defeat Moloch. He defeated the hero instead and had the body brought back and dumped to show that the hero was not very heroic in his efforts. Moving on in the story, we then see the individual who is going to be called Zaius speaking with an individual who is going to be called Mercurio. So we're getting Hercules, Mercury, and Zeus so far, in my humble opinion. We will later introduce a named individual who is the equivalent to Diana. Why Morrow didn't just use those names, but instead came up with Diona, Mercurio, and Zeus, I'm not sure. We'd have to ask him, and I don't think we can anymore. I believe Mr. Morrow's passed on. But Zayas and Mercurio speaking, walking, we're seeing that Zayas figured that this hero was not going to last very long, and he has put into motion the acquisition, and I'm throwing up quote fingers here, which you can't see because it's an audio medium, but if it were video, you would be seeing my quote fingers. And we proceed with them through this some portion of the city and come up into like a techie laboratory kind of room. And then we see that Zayas flicks some switches and moves some gear level levers, and we are transported to a place that more resembles Earth. Not that this doesn't resemble Earth, but I mean, we currently don't have pterodactyls, so. But I mean, it could be like a future Earth or something like that, perhaps. And I say future because of the stylings of the gigantic city ships suspended in the heavens, which we don't currently have. So combination of the way it looks and the way it functions, perhaps it's in the future of Earth. We don't know. We are looking centuries away, unaware of the part he is destined to play in a series of events that will alter the face of history. A man watches a tranquil sea froth into foaming whitecaps and prepares for the challenge. Then we zoom in and we see an individual, much like the captain of the Minnow, piloting a dual-sailed vessel here. Perhaps a storm is approaching. The seas are starting to whip up a little bit. And in the clouds, we see Zayas, and who we are going to find out is Diona, watching. And then in the midst of this, Zayas shouts, "Now!" And he throws a switch, and a huge, huge, I say, wave washes over. We are going to find out Mr. Eric Cleese is his name, washes him over the boat or just sinks the boat completely. And on the next page is five panels of Mr. Cleese in the water and then going through some sort of teleportational, interdimensional, some kind of warp. Narrator tells us he feels himself stretched and warped by the awesome forces. Blinding flashes of coruscating light and ululating wall of the storm blending with his own anguished scream. Then everything goes black. Next panel. "So, you've survived. Come, Zayas awaits you." And we see Mr. Cleese sitting here on a beach. We can presume from this panel, we see later on that, yeah, it's pretty much a beach that he's washed up on. "Are you like a goddess?" And she responds, "Of course. Your transportation, young lord." And it's a chariot being pulled by a team of one Pegasus and a Griffin. So they are getting along well enough, which kind of surprises me. I didn't think Griffins got along with much anything. But, well, I mean, in my experience with Griffins, of course, that's my takeaway. A Griffin and a Pegasus pulling the chariot that Mr. Cleese and Diona get on, and they're flying, and she's kind of filling them in. And he's saying, "Well, you know, this is interesting, but flying and everything, and it could, man, if this is my imagination, you know, if I'm having a dream, I want to dream something a little bit more fantastical, a little bit more futuristic than a chariot pulled by these mythological beasts." And Diona says, "Oh, okay." Poof! And changes it into a flying, like, anti-grav multi-person car. Looks like it holds maybe four people. And they're sitting on the bench seat in front there, winging towards a floating city, much like the city we saw in the second panel of the book. A little different, but you definitely get the idea that the two are the same. If you were confused by the fact that Diona was there, because she was also in a couple of the scenes in the background between Zayas and Mercurio as they were going to set the... Well, she was speaking with Zayas, as a matter of fact, when he, quote-unquote, took Cleese from Earth to wherever this is, which is interesting. This is the second story that involves a human being taken from his time and place on Earth to somewhere else. The other was, the first was to a future setting, and this is to, I think what we're going to find out, I don't know if it, yeah, I think it specifically says this is like an alternate Earth. So sideways travel here, travel into the future in the other instance of a simple individual being taken, a regular individual, being taken to extraordinary situations. As he's following her, now she is drawn, interestingly, she has a top on, much like I would imagine Amazon's wore, because it covers one side, but the other side, her breast is free flowing, shall we say. So, Mr. Morrow trying to be a little racy here with, some of the freedoms that he has in this book as opposed to a mainstream Marvel or DC book. He really takes advantage of that here in a little bit later in this story. Funnily enough, it doesn't do anything, doesn't add anything. I'm not sure, but artistic choice. No doubt about it, Cleese, you flipped. A city floating in the sky, weird aircraft, a gorgeous goddess named Diona, and somehow you've put on about 40 pounds of beef. So he's a bigger, thicker man than he was on Earth. Because he is going to be this dimension's Heracles, Hercules, whatever other names he goes by. I know it as Hercules. And yes, the little chant, Hercules, Hercules, is going through my head too now that I've said that. So yeah, that's a nifty little earworm that I'm going to have to try to get rid of. So Diona escorts him and introduces Mr. Cleese to Zaius and Mercurio. They all start. Zaius now takes over as he is the leader of this group and the one who has put into motion the fact that Mr. Cleese is even here. So we follow along. He's telling the origin story for his peoples. Your records, your historians have, I see, relegated us to the status of gods and goddesses, romantic figures in quaint fables designed to amuse children. We are, in fact, visitors from another world. Astronauts is the term in your current usage, I believe. I'm attempting to use the vernacular of your 10th century. I've studied through the chronosphere, crash-landed on your planet when it was a young, burgeoning world alive and pregnant with all of its possibilities, and in short, mucked it up. So we see that the sons of man and the daughters of whatever these people of Zaius is, mixed. And in that mixing, between the mixing of the genetics but also the perception of Zaius's people, created much of the mythology that we have learned about as human beings, both Greek and Roman myth, whichever you want to focus on. There's a panel here showing multiple creatures, and then several panels showing perceived matings going on to let you know in that part of the story that that's what it is. And so, we must repair the damage, leave things as they were, or else be left to our fate and our failings, he finishes his story. And Cleese says, and here's where I come in? Precisely. Non-interference means just that. You must be our advocate. The intermingling of our bloods, plus the genetic experimentation, has produced a world teeming with species of humanity that war constantly with one another for dominance. They believe their gods have forsaken them, so they create new ones, or embrace the unrepentant others, such as Moloch. Ah, I think we're getting to the nitty-gritty. Moloch is one of them as well. He's the big bad and has separated himself, choosing to want and to do things his own way, as opposed to the way that Zaius believes it should be done as the overall leader of the peoples. Moloch was a member of our group, but in the calamitous crash that stranded us, he lost what he loved most, his Althea. The loss altered his rationality. Zaius, do not mince words. He is mad, says Diona. Very well, mad. Quite mad. And as the vauntiest scientist of our learned assemblage, he soon became the most destructive and dangerous. Diona jumps in here, says, the home council will table our rescue until we can undo the results of our meddling, give them positive programming towards a hopeful future, and Moloch blocks us at every turn. So basically, they have radioed home, and home says, yeah, we'll come and rescue you, but in the amount of time that you have been there, you have really buggered things up. So you need to fix that first before we take you away, before you're able to leave. So that's kind of your penance in messing things up, is you need to fix them, and then we will come and rescue you. And that's where Mr. Cleese comes in, which we will see. His name is Eric Cleese, and somebody mishears it and says, Hercule, Her, 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 Kukulcan or something like that is how he hears it. And so I guess that is where we get Hercules from in our mythologies. So the story continues and Eric fights a little bit and Zaya says, no, you are the hero we're looking for here. I'll prove it to you. Take this rope and pull from the other room, which you can't see, what is at the end of the rope into this room, and it will be the test of your strength. And so Eric pulls and starts, you know, working, finally sliding into the room against the force that is exerted opposite. Eric pulls a brace of centaur that have been harnessed up and were pulling against him. So that is proof enough for him that he is strong enough to pull a brace of centaurs. Did I call them centaurs before? Centaurs into the room. So now he goes off to sleep, ponders what he's going to do, what he believes, if he's even awake, is this real, you know, et cetera, as many, if not most, rational people kind of would at this point. He wakes up the next morning, woken rather by Diona, and now she is wearing a blouse that is but a strap from shoulder to waist between her now exposed breasts. So she's basically walking around topless today as the escort. I guess she took his measure with just one hanging out yesterday, and today she realized that it's okay. Eric can handle himself when faced with my beauty. And so she's now walking around basically topless as his guide to this floating city. So indeed, they start touring. She shows him this and that, a marketplace and different things. You see in the background and the foreground, different aspects of things that have been woven into our mythologies, further showing that what Zaius said as by way of explanation is, you know, what is going on for Mr. Cleese. Finally, he says he needs a drink to, you know, kind of settle all of this once and for all in his mind. And Diona takes him to a bar, again, full of, full of topless women and creatures and individuals from mythology. I recognize a couple of the individuals here in the bar. Their host at the bar is intended to be Dionysus, which Diona plays with him a little bit, and he goes off. They sit down at a table here, which allows Mr. Morrow to draw Diona's boobs laying on the table, because the table is at the right height that when she leans forward, yeah, it's really odd to me. We see another portion of the bar where a couple individuals are not happy with the service and are trying to pay their fare and move on, because Dionysus is going to throw them out. And they attempt to pay with teeth and bones. So these are a couple of the more animalistic races that populate the city here. And they're paying with a method that is not accepted in the bar. And there's some fussing, and the bouncer, Cleese notes, is 9 feet tall. Now, I don't recognize what he is supposed to be. He looks kind of like some sort of animal, but kind of not. So I'm not sure. It might be just a Moro creation here, but he grabs up the two individuals who we find out are named Flan and Slag and attempts to throw them out. They fight back, and there's a little brawl going on, and Cleese decides to jump in and kind of gets shoved away by the three individuals because they don't realize that he is coming to maybe try to help, you know, straighten things out and quell the aggression that everybody has here, the violence that he's seeing. But he is thrown across the room inadvertently and gets his dander up and now starts to force himself into the situation as Hercules. And so his strength is far superior even to the 9-foot-tall bouncer. And he has no problem squelching things here and putting it to rest. And because Flan and Slag perceive him as being a rescuer, they say that they will join him free of charge. So Hercules, in his journeys here, has already a couple flunkies that will go around with him. One is kind of looks like a baboon or a mandrill. And the other, I don't know, looks maybe like another sort of monkey, or maybe a furry, like a cat or dog creature. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. But the one definitely looks like a mandrel. He's got the colored stripes on his snout, which is a little bit elongated. So another night's rest, and they wake up the next day, and they start off on their trek to defeat Moloch. Hercules is riding a mastodon. The mandrel is riding a two-legged, large beaked bird, which probably has a name, but I'm not sure. Maybe it's a giant dodo or something like that. And then the third member, the furry cat-like or dog-like creature, appears to be riding a woolly rhino here in the background. He comes, O Lord, is the final panel. And off to the side here, we presume this is Moloch saying, so he does. How kind of sweet Zeus to continuously provide us with such diversion. We must prepare some surprises for our eventual guest. And so, interesting story. The art, Gray Morrow, he is a master with pen and ink and color. Very, very, very well done. Very wordy, I think. I guess for the first installment of the story, there was a lot of information to get to us. I don't know. Being a visual medium, I prefer to visualize the story rather than read the story. I've probably said it before, but, if you really want to write, then write a prose novel and, be done with it. But I don't know. I like pretty pictures in my comic books more than I like necessarily the words. I understand the need for words and narration characters interacting back and forth is okay, but this is just, this is of, shall we say, Claremontian proportion as far as the amount of wordage. All right, next page is an ad for new releases. We have black and white cover mock-ups for Gru the Wanderer, Bernie Wrightson's Master of the Macabre, which the first issue I spoke on last episode, Edge of Chaos, Alien Worlds, Twisted Tales, Captain Victory, Silver Star, and Elric, which I believe we've spoken of all of those books so far. So now the next page is a book we have not spoken of yet, and we will not for about four more months. So that's about four. I think I'll be able to do each month in just one episode. Four months of releases, though, and it's called Bold Adventures Presents Time Force. And it's from Mr. Bill Dubay and Rudy Nebris. So there's a full page cover mock-up and text about it here. So they're really pushing this book. Also, John Severin and Trevor Von Eden are involved in the book. Third story. So Trevor has a story in here, and Severin. Yeah, so they both, let's see. Yeah, they both have do the art for stories. There are three stories apparently in here. All right, our second story in this issue of Edge of Chaos comes to us by way of scripting penciled and inked by Don Lomax, and it's called Redeeming Strain. January 7, 1994. So this is in the past. Their future, our past. Our past by what, 30 years? Wow. After many false starts, only two cultures have demonstrated growth advancements sufficient to allow continuance. I have increased the gamma bombardment in regular stages with no marked effect on either culture's development save their resistance. I feel I am on the right track, but there is so little time. And it's an older gentleman. The art shows him writing in a notebook, in his logbook here. And he appears to be in the midst of some sort of laboratory. We see all kinds of equipment here. But now we do have either view screens or windows. Can't really tell. There's nothing on them. They're just colored differently than the rest of the mechanics. Next entry is August 21, 1994. And he seems to be either he's sick and or old. And so his faculties and abilities are diminishing. And he's logging that as well as the updates on the two cultures. December 12, 1994. Still carrying on. And we finally get some indication of what he has here. He has two cultures of mites, M-I-T-E-S, mites. And one is blue, the blues, and the other are the reds. Though my sentimental choice is the communal mites I have dubbed the blues, they are agricultural, loving homebodies with exceptional intelligence, but I fear them too weak to survive in the outside world. while on the other hand, the Reds are strong, warlike, and quite capable. With the fissure between the two independent worlds closed, I pray I will be forgiven for my clinical brutality. Because each world of mites is on a microscope slide, and in a whatever kind of viewing or experimental machinery he has them in here, he has slid the two slides together with a clack for us, but with a kablam for them. So here at the top of this page where he describes the blue and the reds, we see what is going on from his viewpoint, the scientist, as he's using pincers to push the two slides together. And then we have in the next panel an image from the mites world where their two worlds are slammed together and the worlds are like two large mountain buttes or something like that with some kind of valley in between where the two slides have been pushed together. Now, immediately the reds attack the blues and the blues don't have really any experience or any methods of defending themselves or being offensive towards the whites, whereas the reds are completely offensive. So, I mean that as far as aggressive, not as in smell or attitude or anything like that. Aggressive as far as attitude. So we see the reds, having just discovered, in essence, the blues, the leader of the reds, Captain Syrix, goes to his queen to ask for further orders. We have already been introduced to Thala and Gratuk, G-R-A-T-Q-U-E, Gratke? I don't know, Gratuk, as the leaders of the Blues. So now, having faced the first sortie of the Reds, the Blues are congregating and trying to figure out what to do, whereas Captain Syrix has gone to his Queen of the Reds to find out what to do on their side. So the Queen, being uber aggressive, wants to conquer and expand her land holdings. So she tells Captain Syrix to go ahead and squash the Blues or whoever they are. They don't necessarily know much about them other than they are something else to conquer. The Blues, on the other hand, are very confused. They've never had to deal with anything like this. They don't really know what to do. The next day, we see the Reds with their advanced equipment. They bridge the gap between the two worlds, erect a bridge that allows them to freely go between, and they launch a massive attack. The Blues start dying right and left. The one panel here where the Reds first attack the Blues is rather nasty and descriptive in what they're doing. It's not the kindest of panels I've seen. The two Blues leaders, or who we perceive as leaders, Thala and Gratuk, both decide that they are going to put everything that they have into protecting their people, and so they attack with a fierceness that belies their blueness, you know, their people, but is also something that the Reds apparently have not encountered. Now we cut back to the scientist here. We see December 13th, 1994. I can no longer control my motor senses. I can barely move, and my sight is nearly gone. I must face the fact I'm dying. I must set them free while I am still able, lest they be trapped forever with no room to expand and multiply. If only I could live long enough to witness the outcome of my little experiments, but no, my time has run its course. So what he does is he takes a hammer and he busts the window. These are indeed windows, right next to the two slides where they've been put together, and opens the window to whatever is outside, whatever the world outside is. In the process of breaking this window, a shard of the glass, or probably just since we're dealing with mites, a minuscule piece of the glass falls away and falls towards the mite world, severing the bridge that the Reds built. So now the Reds have retreated, thinking that the destruction of their bridge was because of the Blues, and the Blues retreat, glad that whatever it is that has occurred, and gives them a moment respite. Perhaps someday their petty differences will be set aside for a common goal, the narrator tells us. And then we see that the scientist is in the Rocky Mountain Institute for Genetic Engineering, and it's a private institute. And then the final three panels, I don't know what this is supposed to be. I don't know if this is the world outside and it's shown to be barren, or it looks like open sores on flesh almost also. So I don't know if that's the mites have infected him, or I don't know what this is supposed to be, but it wasn't very clear to me. If anybody out there has this issue and can look and tell me what the final three panels are supposed to represent, that will be cool. Otherwise, I guess I'll assume that they are supposed to depict mountains, and we see that the area that this institute is just completely barren. It's zooming away like it's rising, like our camera is rising in elevation. So yeah, I'm not really sure. Inside back panel cover, don't miss issue 2, Edge of Chaos, coming soon from Pacific Comics. In the back panel, an advert for Somerset Holmes. Alone, vulnerable, terrified. She doesn't know who she is, where she came from, or why they're trying to kill her. Jones and Anderson, this summer from Pacific Comics. Looks like just a couple months wait till we get to the first issue of Somerset Holmes. So that's cool. A couple books advertise this issue that actually are coming up. So something we get to look forward to. Somerset Holmes and Bold Adventures. And let's take a quick looky look here at the schedule. And it looks like the next Pacific Comics episode, we will be talking about Alien Worlds, Bernie Wrightson, Master of the Macabre, and Elric of Melniboné. But before that, we have another issue of Elflord to talk about for Newsprint Commando. So Elflord for the regular show, and Pacific Tuesday, Alien Worlds, Bernie Wrightson, and Elric. So thanks for listening. Hope you were entertained enough to stick around for next time. Talk to you guys then. Ciao.